supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got a jam-packed show for you, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we will talk about sprouting, a popular way to grow your own over the winter. But are there dangers involved? And if so, how do you avoid them? We'll also touch on the hot, trendy new alternative of growing your own microgreens in little trays of soil. And gather round anyone of a certain age who ever lived in or near Philadelphia, because the legendary Gene London will be joining us to talk about the fabulous collection of Hollywood costumes that he is bringing to this year's Philadelphia Flower Show. You won't want to miss it, and you won't. It's coming up after a couple of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing good, Bob. How are you, sir?
I'm great, thank you. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for the show. It's a great show.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Where are you, man?
Media, PA, Middletown Township.
Okay, good. What can we do for Bob?
I have a question about ivy growing on trees.
Right.
So I have a good number of trees on my property. I have some pine trees run along the street. There's ivy that grows on them, and I pull it off every once in a while because it's ugly. And there's one tree in particular that's between my house and my neighbor's house. It's actually my neighbor's tree.
Right.
It's really big, I don't know, 60 to 80 feet. And their yard slopes down, so it kind of overhangs my house a little bit. And it is loaded with ivy on the upper sections of the tree. So I was looking at it one day, and I thought, wow, I wonder if that ivy, you know, like I said, I take it off the other trees because it's ugly, but I wonder if it's damaging to the tree. And if so, this is a really big tree, and I don't want it to fall on my house if it dies, or any parts of the branches to fall on my house. So on the back side of the tree, so I walk around the tree towards my neighbor's side of the property, there's a root or a trunk to the ivy that's like several inches thick. So that root, you know, runs up the tree to where the tree starts
branching. Wait a minute. Is it hairy?
Yes.
Oh, my God. That's poison ivy. Danger. Danger, Will Robinson.
Okay.
Danger.
Okay.
Danger.
Well,
ivy will have some kind of hairiness to the root.
Okay.
But when you get a really thick root that is really hairy growing up the side of a tree, and especially when a lot of the, quote, ivy is up high, you should assume that you have poison ivy.
Well, part of the reason I was calling, right, was maybe to say, hey, what should I do? Should I chop away at that root? But this is really good information now.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to touch it.
Yeah, you get a saw and you start spreading that sap all over the place. You could be in the emergency room. Poison ivy, extreme exposure, is the only medical emergency in botany. I mean, people's throats close up. It can be really serious if you get overwhelmed. So first, make the ID. Second, if you sever it as it's going up the tree, then all of the ivy in the top of the tree will die. Typically with, quote, real ivy, English ivy, Irish ivy, sometimes it's Virginia creeper. If it's not toxic, then all you have to do is sever where it's coming out of the ground, wait a season, then you pull the dead stuff out of the tree. But if you have a gigantic old poison ivy vine, you need to go very carefully. So you want to identify it, and then I want you to do a couple of things. I want you to go to our website, youbetyourgarden.org, and we have a couple of articles there on poison ivy. We do address the topic of what to do when there's a giant vine growing up a tree. There's a company in the Philadelphia area, a guy we've had on the show several times. He actually holds symposiums on professional poison ivy removal. I'm almost certain I can remember the name of his website. I think it's I Don't Want Poison Ivy Anymore. And he offers first professional removal services. He brings a crew out with Tyvek suits. And if you wind up that you can't afford that or you don't want that, he can warn you about all the things not to do. So if it's regular ivy, just cut it off at the base, tincture a time, pull the dead stuff out of the tree, keep cutting it back so it doesn't grow up the tree anymore. If it's poison ivy, back off and come up with a real sincere workable plan. The stuff hanging in the tree will still be toxic even after it's dead and brown.
Okay, that's great. I really appreciate your help.
All right.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Be careful, Bob.
All right, have a great day.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Ryan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
I am doing fine today. Ryan, how are you, sir?
I'm doing fine as well.
And where is Ryan doing fine?
Edmond, Oklahoma.
What can we do for you, Rye?
A couple of years ago, I went ahead and painted the ceiling of my front porch this Hank blue. I was in the South, and they said that it kept away mud daubers and like paper wasps and birds from nesting. And believe it or not, for the last 2 years, I haven't had any of those types of pests or nuisances. And I was just wondering, is it just a placebo effect on my front porch, or is this really something backed up by science or something?
Well, it would be a placebo effect if you no longer wanted to be on the porch, Ryan. Now, this is a porch that used to get a lot of mud dauber nests?
Yes, all the time.
All the time. And what color was the old porch?
It was brown.
It was brown. Oh, okay. And I missed what your adjective. What kind of blue was this?
Well, I took a trip in South Carolina, and all the ceilings of all the porches on these southern houses were painted this light blue, and they called it Haint, H-A-I-N-T, I think.
In southern folklore, this color was very specifically used for this specific purpose to deter wildlife nesting on the porch.
Yeah, that's what they told me, at least what the tour said, And so when I got tired of trying to kill mud dauber nests and scraping them off and being attacked by red wasps every time I walk out my front door, I just gave it a try. And 2 years and no more birds, mud daubers, or paper wasps.
Well, that is interesting. I can tell you what I know, but you may be teaching us something. I'm going to go to the books after this one, and I also know who to call. Years ago, we had a question, very serious question, a woman who was allergic to, quote, bee stings. And the question from this listener who was terribly bee sting allergic, that these paper wasps and mud daubers used to make nests around her house all the time and flipped her out. And I asked one of our insect experts, Linda Gilkinson, and she said this has been studied for years and nobody can figure out why they make their nests in the places that they do. There's no consistency. There's no reason to believe they come back to the same place year after year. Now, I will add to that that it is a well-known fact in organic agriculture that you can attract certain insects with certain colors. This is used to kill pest insects. Anybody who's had an infestation of aphids on houseplants in their home knows that you can put up yellow sticky cards and the aphids will throw themselves at it. But light blue, I can postulate a theory here. So tell me what you think. First, mud daubers and paper wasps are going to be very attracted to brown, because it's going to be a natural color, it's going to be like the trees and stuff they attach themselves to in the wild. But if it is exactly the right color of blue, is it possible that they're not even seeing it as a solid surface, but as an extension of blue sky?
And that was what my theory was. That was the basis of, that's basically what I came up with on my own, but I looked on the internet and I tried to find some information on it, and I was able to find lots of, when I type in Haint Blue, I was able to see lots of pictures of porches, but nobody told me why it works, but it seems to so far.
Well, I tell you, yours is the perfect solution to test, because people who are allergic are terrified of attracting these creatures. And, you know, if you are bee allergic, bee sting allergic, so-called, and the mud daubers or hornets start building on your porch, you have a terrible summer. You, even if nothing comes near you, you're flipping out the whole time. And this does no harm, and it's a great idea. So I hereby recommend it, and I would love to hear from other people who do this and see what the results are. There's absolutely no harm, and I can think of a reasonable reason it might work. What a great idea. Thank you, Ryan.
No problem. I'd like to take credit for it, but really it just came from visiting plantation houses in the South.
You're a great reporter. You are collecting and disseminating information. Thanks so much. We'll pass this on. We'll be talking about it.
Okay.
You take care. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn our friends in Northern Virginia that I'll appear at the Capitol Home Show at the Dulles Expo Center in Chantilly, Virginia, from Friday, February 27th through Sunday, March 1st. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to examine the safety of your sprouting, talk to Mr. Gene London about the historic Hollywood he's bringing to the Philadelphia Flower Show, and take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Burpee, celebrating their 139th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, fruits of all kinds, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com. And by the Espoma Company, makers of Hollytone brand organic plant food, developed for feeding hollies, azaleas, evergreens, and other acid-loving plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up a little later in the show, sprouting from seed is a great way to keep growing your own over the winter time, especially in a cold climate. But there are concerns about the safety of sprouting. So we're going to walk you through the ABCs of safe sprouting and its wonderful alternative, growing those hot, trendy little microgreens. We're also going to take lots more of your fabulous phone calls, but now it's time to excite everyone of a certain age in the Philadelphia area and in beyond in many locales by introducing today's special, very special guest, Mr. Gene London. Gene, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, Mike, it's so nice to just hear you talk. So it's such a privilege to talk to you today.
Now, we have you on the air not because you are a beloved children's show host whose show aired out of Philadelphia for many, many years, Cartoon Corners, General Stores. Like many people of a certain age, I could sing your songs. I met you at a broadcast pioneers luncheon where I'll make everybody else in the world jealous. I was sitting next to Pixann at the time, Jane Norman.
Oh, how great. Oh, that's wonderful.
And then you blew in from New York at the last minute, and the other people there explained that you had this massive collection of Hollywood costumes, authentic Hollywood costumes that were worn in film. And as you know, you well know, because you've been probably working 25-hour days to get ready for this, your costumes are going to be exhibited at this year's Philadelphia Flower Show to go along with their theme of celebrating the movies.
It's true. When I first started my show in Philadelphia on WCAU, I just had my audition, and then the next week I was on the air, and it was amazing. It was an overnight success. But while I was in Philadelphia, which was for 3 days, taping all my shows, which run every day of the week, I went to see the flower show. And it was amazing. It wasn't at the downtown facility in Philadelphia. It was in a lovely old building as I remember it, and I just loved it. I've always loved flowers ever since I was a little kid.
But I have to take you back and remind you that you saw that show at the Civic Center, and everyone's memory of that is going down this long escalator. And when you got to the bottom, the show floor exploded out in front of you.
Exactly as you've explained it.
Traveled to another world.
I'll have about 50 costumes there of great stars from great films of the Golden Age. And then next door, they have a tea at Terra, and I'll be having my Gone with the Wind costumes on exhibit there as well. So it's just absolutely a love affair for me. And for all the people who keep saying, you're going to be doing it, can I meet you? And I say, can I meet you? I'm so approachable. Just have fun. And it's so anyone listening who watched my show and would like to meet me, I'll be waiting for you. We'll be having VIP tours, and we'll be having regular times when people will go in and see all these beautiful costumes.
And you have all the heavy hitters, right? You've got a Grace Kelly. You got a Marilyn Monroe.
We've got more than we have the most Marilyn Monroe dresses of any collector in the world. We just came back from Florence and from Prague, where we did an exhibit of Grace. She's, for some reason, a perfect example of a human being different from the person they play. And she's become the biggest star of all time. She never would have believed it. She only wanted to be wonderful. That was what she said. And she said, if I have to be a symbol of something, let it be sex. And she just had such incredible sex appeal. Marilyn was, when she was very young, she went to the movies like everyone did in that time, the time of the Great Depression, for escape. And she saw Jean Harlow, and she asked her godmother, who's that lady? And she said, Jean Harlow, they call her baby. She said, what's that dirty mark on her face? And she said, it's not a dirty mark. It's a beauty mark. She said, will you do one on me? She said, of course I will. And she said, one day you're going to be Jean Harlow, aren't you? She said, I want that more than anything. And she did become the new Jean Harlow.
You don't get this opportunity to see these Hollywood outfits, these amazing gowns, these things that were created solely for the movies. How many Marilyns will you have?
Well, many, 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 and also many Joan Crawford. I don't know if you even remember Joan Crawford. She was tiny, 5'3", but she really had such a strong will. She was very, very strong. And she's the one who started me on my collection. Also, we have Betty Davis, who was tiny again, but very, very, very big in stature. Doris Day, Clara Bow. Clara Bow is a silent film star that most people don't know who she is.
And let me close the circle for you. Grace Kelly, synonymous with Philadelphia High Society and the Flower Show. When my mother would take me to the Flower Show as a child, she explained that we were leaving our working class life behind for the day and we were mingling with people just like Grace Kelly.
Grace Kelly is amazing. We have many of her gowns and dresses, and we also have an exact replica that my staff and I created of her wedding dress, which was donated to the Philadelphia Museum of Art.
Right, when she became the real-life princess.
Yeah, she was amazing. She had mastered the art of being Grace Kelly at school.
And now you're bringing Grace Kelly full circle. You're bringing her back to her origins, to the main line, to the flower show, which is the epitome of not only the main line, the high culture of Philadelphia, but the place where all of the working class individuals, all of the row homes, all the kids from Kensington, from Port Richmond, from Tacony Mayfair could go.
From Northeast Philadelphia, from everywhere.
And be right next, right up with those people. Everybody was equal.
I know. It's just amazing. I think that Philadelphia should have a statue of Grace Kelly. I don't understand why it doesn't.
Now, but you have exhibited these costumes all over the world.
Yes. And in Moscow, everywhere. It's just amazing how America, how American films during the Golden Age appeal to the whole world. The idea is that the screen was the window of opportunity, the magic of America, the wonder of our country.
Now, Gene,
it's too much to talk about. Yes.
You've done all these major exhibits, the best museums in the world, perhaps the Smithsonian. You know, these are all, you know, the top level of culture. The Flower Show is a wonderful event. But it only runs for a little over a week from February 28th through March 8th, and it's a big event. I wonder if you felt like I did, a kid from Tacony Mayfair getting to put on a major exhibit at the Philadelphia Flower Show with all the places you've exhibited your gowns.
Oh, no, Philadelphia, even though I lived in New York the whole time I did my show, Philadelphia is my hometown, and it's coming back, now that I'm older, coming back to Philadelphia with my collection is like a chance to meet all my fans, which are legion. They're very devoted to me the way we used to be devoted to stars like Lana Turner and Clark Gable and Hedy Lamarr in the old days. And it's a chance for me to meet my fans who are really old friends. And it's also a chance to show Hollywood, which is really one of the biggest businesses in America was Hollywood, was the movie factories, was the town, was the stars, was the clothes.
Gene, the things that Hollywood...
The
magic that Hollywood imprinted on people through the movies is exactly what you did for so many years on television, and I hope
I can grab a
tiny little piece of here on the radio. Gene London of Cartoon Corner's General Store, beloved children's show host in Philadelphia and beyond, will exhibit his historic Hollywood costumes at this year's Philadelphia Flower Show, which runs from February 28th through March 8th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center. The theme is the movies. I wondered how they were going to bring the movies to the Flower Show, and I wonder no longer. Not only will you see the great exhibits of the Flower Show, but you'll see all these wonderful original Hollywood costumes, really bringing a new level of show to the Flower Show.
Mike, you leave me speechless.
Good. That's my job. Gene London,
wonderful.
Thank you so much for what you're doing for the Flower Show this year, and thank you so much for spending this time with us today.
And thank you for letting me be here with you. I enjoyed it so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And now, back to your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Phyllis, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Phyllis. How are you?
I'm just fine, thank you. How are you?
I am doing well. Where is Phyllis Fine?
I'm in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
What can we do for you, Phyllis?
Well, I'm having an infestation of four-lined plant bugs, and it's been going on for about 3 years. I've had them identified by the Greene County Extension Service, so I know that's what I'm dealing with. They started with oregano plants. Oregano and thyme is the only thing I have edible that's growing in this garden. They proceeded to the fall anemone, rutabaga, phlox. They're getting also ivy, and they're getting close to the crane's bill and coral bells, and they're getting dangerously near my Japanese maple tree. So I don't know what else to do. I've followed the instructions from the Extension Service. I've treated them with neem oil and with an organic insecticidal soap early in May. I've cut back the plants so they won't be hosts. And I'm not having any success. So I'm turning to you to fix this problem.
Okay. I have heard of the, quote, four-lined plant bug. I've not had any personal experience with it, so I'm going to do the best I can. Now, okay. You say you're only growing a couple of herbs in your garden.
Yes. Well, I'm willing to forfeit those to eradicate this problem. I won't use them if I have to treat the garden with something, you know, some harsh chemical.
Oh, no, you shouldn't have to. You shouldn't have to. But that's what they first showed up on.
Yeah, they started on the oregano and had a wonderful time on those. And then adjacent to the oregano were fall anemone, which they then proceeded to devour. And then they made their way around the rest of the garden.
And the herbs, are they just growing in flat ground?
Yes.
Okay. You don't have any kind of raised beds or anything like that?
No.
And do you feed your plants with anything?
No.
And how do you water?
Rain. And Occasionally, if it gets really dry here, I water from the house.
This past year is the first year they showed up?
No. This is a problem that's been going on for about 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried the first year before it was a confirmed diagnosis.
Right.
Feeding them with neem oil.
Right.
And then second year, I tried neem oil, and then I tried this organic insecticidal soap, and then I tried a combination of both. Anyway, it's just not working.
Right. And did you use the oils and the soaps in the correct way? That is, you sprayed them directly on the visible pests?
Yes, and underneath the leaves as well, because I think that's where they like to hang out.
Neem oil will only affect a pest that it smothers. Insecticidal soap will only affect a pest that it smothers. So with oils and soaps, you actually have to smother the pests. One thing I would do is I would go out and I would invest in an inexpensive row cover. This is a light fabric blanket. I want you to build up a little raised berm or raised bed of some kind. And get a row cover with some hoops, and I want you to grow the herbs under that row cover with the edges tucked well down, completely surrounded with soil. The pests can't get through to it. That seems to be one of the plants that's bringing them in. So right away, don't let them get at those plants, physical barrier. Then the next thing I want you to do, which makes perhaps no sense but is probably going to get rid of your problem, I want you to take bird bath saucers, sink them in the ground all throughout your garden, and then I want you to pick a nice shady spot in your garden. It's somewhere near where all this damage is going on, and I want you to put a couple of bricks on the ground. I want you to put a board over top of the bricks and then cover that with old carpeting or plant containers or something else. But this is an area that's going to stay cool and moist out of the sun.
Okay.
So you've created a toad abode. Toads will live in this little bat cave that we just created with bricks and a board, and they'll come out at night. They'll go to the water-filled basins because they love water, and then they will eat their weight in plant pests for you every night. And if I remember correctly, toads are very effective against the four-lined plant bug. You also want to put bird baths right in the center of the infested areas as well, so that when birds come flying in for a drink or a little bath, they get to scan your plants. They will also eat some of your pests. If you want to increase the number of birds that will do this, you can hang suet feeders outside right now. Those little cakes of suet in the wire cages, hang those from the maple that you're worried about. Hang them from other plants, again, in the infested area. This will attract the meat-eating birds that'll make short shift of the bugs next season. Between the birds and the toads and that one cover, you'll stand a good fighting chance. And then if you have further problems, I want you to call us back as soon as you see them breaking out again.
Okay, I will do that. That's great. I will try all three of those. Thanks, Mike. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you. Good luck.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody once again that this year's edition of the Fabulous Philadelphia Flower Show is coming up soon. From February 28th through March 8th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center, I'll be a guest speaker at the Bartlett Tree Care Symposium on the Thursday morning of the show, and then I'll hang around and answer all your quarrelsome questions when I do my lecture in the gardener's studio on the show floor at 5 p.m. that Thursday, which is March 5th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to examine the safety of your sprouting and take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Burpee, celebrating their 139th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, fruits of all kinds, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com. And by the Espoma Company, makers of Hollytone brand organic plant food, developed for feeding hollies, azaleas, evergreens, and other acid-loving plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to a very intriguing question of the week. One way to keep growing despite the winter weather and lack of sunshine and frigid cold is, of course, to produce your own sprouts. People have been doing it forever. But there are concerns about food safety in sprouting both commercial and at home. We'll address those. We'll tell you all the things you can do to be a safe sprouter. And we'll also touch on a wonderful option called microgreen growing that removes many of the potential dangers. It's coming up after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 888-346-9499. Virginia, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi there, Mike. Glad to talk to you.
I am glad to talk to you. Virginia, where are you?
In Berwyn, Pennsylvania.
What can we do for Virginia in Berwyn?
We have a never-ending supply of organic material from our seven horses. So I'm always looking for ways to help with recycling my organic supplies.
Absolutely.
So what we do now is we have a big bin, and actually have a couple of places on the property that we place what we remove from the stalls. And the reason I say that is because we have shaving, not straw, which is relevant because you probably know that the mushroom farmers will take horse manure if it's mixed with straw. But for some reason, and maybe you could tell me, they don't like shaving.
Right, because the oils that are present in certain woods are going to inhibit the fungal growth that they're after. All mushroom spawn has a preferred host, and the very simple carbohydrates that are in straw are very useful for growing the button mushrooms and the portobello mushrooms that are the mainstay of the mushroom farms in Pennsylvania.
Oh, thanks. I didn't know that. I always wondered.
So where are you getting your wood shavings? Do you know what they are?
No. I now use something called pellets, and I would think that they're hardwood, but I don't know exactly.
But you're buying a commercial product.
I absolutely am.
Well, it should just be one or two phone calls or flicks through the website to find out exactly what kind of wood is involved. Now, horse manure is not to be used randomly. It is not a balanced fertilizer at all. And when it is fresh, that's before it's completely composted, it's incredibly weedy. Because you can see this as it comes out the back end of the horse. They have very inefficient digestive systems. And a lot of weeds pass through unchallenged. So people who use raw manure often become accidental grain farmers. Horse manure, for any use, has to be completely composted. That means it will be greatly reduced in size. It will no longer be hot to the touch. It will be cool to normal to the touch, and it will no longer smell like horse manure.
I can attest to that. We develop some wonderful black stuff that people put in their cars and drive away with.
When it's dry and crumbly and free of heat and smell, horse manure is an ultimate food for lawns, lawn grasses, sweet corn, field corn, asparagus, and virtually any other crop that does not produce fruit. It is a terrible fertilizer for tomatoes, despite old wives' tales, because it has an excess of nitrogen and no phosphorus. So it grows really big plants, but it inhibits the fruiting.
Well, that's fascinating because our tomatoes did not do very well.
Now, if you want to get cagey, you can use well-composted horse manure, mix it with other organic elements like rock phosphate and green sand and bone meal, and then you can make a balanced fertilizer. Or once it's completely composted, you can just be done and tell people to spread it on lawns, use it to feed their asparagus beds, grow all the corn that you'd ever want, potatoes, lettuces, all these things that don't produce flowers that you want the plant growth to be strong. That's what horse manure is for.
Well, maybe we'll replace the tomato bed with asparagus.
There you go. And you can combine other elements with the horse manure, or if you make regular compost with fall leaves and maybe some kitchen waste and other stuff, you can mix some composted horse manure in with that, and then the other nutrients will balance it out. Just remember that horse manure alone, even composted, equals big plants, few fruits.
Fascinating.
All right, Virginia.
Thanks for your information.
Good luck, and take good care of your horses.
I will.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Don, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I'm calling because I had a house plant here that I bought from a nursery, a seed catalog. It grew quite well. Queen's Tear grows from a bulb. And the illustration in the seed catalogs always showed a flower that's supposed to develop on the plant. I had this for several years. I never got a flower out of it. Do you know anything about that plant?
Where are you, Don?
Well, I kept it as a house plant next to a sunny window here.
Yeah, but
I'm
where?
In North Idaho at Priest River. I'm up near the Washington state line.
And you say you have a Queen's Tear.
I had. I don't have it anymore.
Oh.
I finally got disgusted with it because it never bloomed.
Okay.
I think it belongs to the cacti family.
I believe it's what's called a bromeliad, but it's not the typical bromeliad. A bromeliad has a very distinctive kind of pineapple-like leaves, and then a big flower stalk will come out of the center. I'm looking in my houseplant book. I do have Queen's Tears up. It doesn't look like a typical bromeliad. The leaves are more lengthy. They don't seem to be as stiff. The flowers that hang down almost seem to come out of a head that would be on a bird of paradise.
Mm-hmm.
And then they hang down. Well, it's supposed to be the easiest bromeliad to grow. You know, but typically the bromeliads, to get them to flower at some time during the season, the indoor temperature. Did you take it out in the summer?
No, I had it on the table next to the sunny window here. It don't use a lot of moisture either.
Well, you had it right in the sun?
Well, a few feet from the window. It
okay.
Got good sun during the daytime.
It's supposed to be kept out of direct sun. It likes a temperature of around 75 degrees during the day, probably dropping down to 50 degrees at night. As you say, never overwater it. In the wild, these are air plants. These are plants like orchids. They don't have their roots in soil. Did you perhaps pot it into a soil mixture?
Yeah, I used potting soil, and it had a bulb. It grew out of a bulb.
Mm-hmm.
It kept a nice dark green color to those spikes or leaves or whatever you want to call them, but I never got it to bloom.
And for blooming, what typically needs to happen is that big difference in temperature, really warm during the day, really cool at night.
Excuse me, but we have about a 40, 50-degree temperature drop in the summer months.
Right, but that's outside.
That's outside, yeah.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
house pretty much stays, don't get much lower than 60 because I don't have no heat on.
Right, so I don't think it got warm enough inside the house for you to get it to bloom. But oddly enough, you know, which I think a bromeliad is very tropical, these things can take very cold temperatures. So if you were to do it over again, I would have put it out for the summer. I would not have potted it in potting soil. I would have potted it up in like rough bark, like they give people for orchids, because it is an air plant. It really wanted to keep its roots nice and loose and not down in soil. And one of the secrets is keep it out of direct sun, but give it bright light and mist it every day. Every morning, they like a good misting. They like to wake up with dew on them that'll evaporate during the day.
Okay.
I think you should be able to get another one to bloom if you really want to give it a second chance.
If I see it, it's available again, I'll try it. It's kind of an odd-looking plant. That's why I bought it.
Yeah, I love the bromeliads across the board. They are absolutely beautiful plants. All right, good luck. Good luck, Don.
I would like to mention I listen to you on KFFC in Spokane, NPR.
Oh, excellent. Thank you so much for doing that, John, and thank you for the plug for them. We love our public radio stations.
I thank you for your comments.
All right, well, thank you for your call, sir. You take care. All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Safe sprouts. You Bet Your Garden producer Alexis Landis, do you have enough of a voice this week to read off this week's question?
I do indeed. Don in Lawrenceville, New Jersey writes, I grow sprouts in the winter as I wait for the fillies to leave Clearwater and spring to come to the Garden State. However, I have been warned of the dangers of sprouting. It's said that sprouting creates conditions that are ideal for the growth of bacteria, including Salmonella, Listeria, and E. coli. I use various methods to grow my sprouts. First, a mason jar with a cheesecloth top. Second, organic soil with seeds in a small tray. And third, spreading seeds on a moist paper towel in a tray. I get about the same results. Do you know the safest and or best way to grow sprouts? Any thoughts on sprouting safety?
Well, food safety is a topic you just have to take seriously. So let's begin with an article published when I was the editor-in-chief of Organic Gardening magazine, written by staff editor Scott Meyer, who himself went on to become the editor after I left to do radio.
So, what's the secret to sprouting safety, then?
One thing mentioned by professionals was that cheesecloth that most people use to cover the open end of their sprouting jar so that they can easily drain the container after they rinse it. Several felt that nylon and similar synthetic materials would be much more mold-resistant. Everybody agreed that absolute sterilization of the sprouting container is essential. You have to be obsessive about washing in really hot water. And rinsing, frequent rinsing of the sprouts. Twice a day is the minimum, but some commercial growers rinse every hour. Some said they did it every 5 minutes.
Okay, back up a bit and give us the elevator pitch on sprouting.
Well, you essentially take the seeds of certain crops, you know, familiar ones like alfalfa and mung beans, which are those classic bean sprouts, and less obvious ones like radishes, cabbage, sunflower, garbanzo beans, clover, buckwheat, peas, broccoli, lentils. Whatever you use, you soak them with filtered or purified water in a sterilized glass container for several hours, empty the water, and then begin rinsing the seeds at fairly high water pressure and draining them completely several times a day. Then eat them as soon as the seeds sprout, which can be 2 to 3 days for wheat and mung beans and up to a week for alfalfa. Don't let them sit around after they sprout.
I'm thinking the faster the better.
You are doubly correct. First, you want to choose seeds that germinate quickly, because fast growing means less time for problems to develop. And then you want to consume them right away so that problems don't have time to develop in storage. Another thing to look for is a high germination rate. That's the percentage of seeds in a packet that tests have shown will grow. This is listed on every seed packet. A professional, quote, sprout man that Scott interviewed said he wouldn't consider using any seeds with a germination rate lower than 90%, and he looked for rates in the high 90s, because any seeds that don't sprout are going to become a breeding ground for mold and disease.
Makes sense. What else?
Be compulsive about drainage. You have to rinse the seed several times a day, and you want zero water left in that container after you're done. Just storing the jar upside down over an open space provides huge levels of protection. And because most of the commercial sprout recalls have involved E. coli contamination, I'd stick with seeds that were organically grown. Organic regulations prohibit the use of the raw manures that can cause E. coli breakouts.
What about our listeners sprouting in trays of, quote, organic soil?
Right, as opposed to all that inorganic soil that's going around. Anyway, sprouting tiny edibles in trays of, quote, soil produces not sprouts but microgreens, the hottest trend in market gardening and home growing right now. And when you grow those baby greens in a soil-free mix under a rack of bright lights, you practically eliminate disease issues, long as you don't overwater, of course.
So his sprouting and microgreen growing are two very different things.
Absolutely. Elizabeth Millard, the indoor kitchen gardening author we had on the show recently, covers both methods in her book. She notes that the range of seeds you can use for each technique is fairly similar, with sprouts generally being edible within a week and microgreens in 2 weeks. What both have in common is that they're much more nutritious per gram than the edible parts of the fully grown plant.
Wow, well, these techniques aren't just a way to garden indoors.
Oh, no, no, no. Produced carefully and correctly, sprouted seeds and little baby greens are nutritional powerhouses.
What about our listeners' third version, sprouting on moist paper towels?
You know, that sounds more like an old-school germination test to me, something you try with sample seeds from an old pack to see if they're still viable. But, you know, if it works and the sprouts look and smell right, more power to him.
Smell right?
Yeah, the indoor gardening expert Millard says that a good sniff is your best protection against bad sprouts. Give them the smell test and, quote, when in doubt, throw it out.
Shouldn't it be, when in doubt, compost or worm bin it?
I stand corrected. Well, that sure was some good advice about safe sprouting and Murray microgreen growing, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to soak my sprouts if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer is Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's webpage wonders. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and like us at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our sprightly editor is Al Banks. Micro Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our new associate producer is Farah Al-Yakut. Our hired hand, Matt Hudecki, well, he's kind of a beanpole sprout. I'm poorly germinated Mike McGrath, and I'll be sure to rinse myself well several times before I see you again next week. Will any fruits grow well on a deck or a balcony? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss the possible cultivation of sweet treats outside of the ground, plus your fabulous phone calls.